Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we introduce today's guest, I want to be sure that we thank our sponsor, OneCause. OneCause is the leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I'd also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training retreats. If you're looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right before you begin any significant planning or launch a capital campaign, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting me or a member of our team to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning retreat? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically about the road ahead. If you're interested, shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Deb. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. I asked Kelly and the organizers at OneCause for the RAISE conference this week if I could interview, you know, four or five of their rock star presenters. And you were on a very short list of, I think we're going to talk to five people this week. You're number four or five. And so you're apparently one of, we'll call you one of Kelly's favorites. And so I'm delighted that you're with me today. Why don't, before we dive into our subject, our conversation, why don't you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, thank you for that generous compliment from our friends at OneCause. I am Deb Barge. I have the privilege of working with the Muscular Dystrophy Association, MDA, as we go by in common terms. We are a 70-year-old organization celebrating our birthday this year. And I am the chief field officer. So I oversee our team across the nation who fundraise through their local events in the past, back when we could do those, and engage their local communities. But it's also the workforce and the philanthropy operations of bringing those donors into a large organization like us, everything from peer-to-peer to gala to just plain old people who love us and want to give a gift and be involved and care about the cause.
So, Deb, are you a lifetime fundraiser or come over from PR and marketing, or what's sort of what's your career story that landed you in this job?
That's a great question. I had the honor when I came out of college of working for Allstate Insurance Company. And when I started, part of my role in corporate relations was managing the Allstate Foundation and giving away money. So I started on the other side. I don't know that there's a lot of us who are fundraisers who used to give away money, but we always talk about one day I'm going to go give away money. I started giving away money. And then when I left Allstate, went right into nonprofit. It was clearly the part of my job I really loved. I started in nonprofit in the comms space and realized what I was actually good at was fundraising.
I really like that story. That's a good one. I you know, a lot of us have very typical stories and a lot of us have sort of backdoor stories. I came in sort of the typical 20 years ago in through the back door, originally working in the program at the organization with my wife. But I don't think I've heard that story. I really like that one, Deb. That's great. So Deb, I am interested. I want to talk about MDA and I want to talk about sort of what it means to be part of the MDA and like organizations. But I saw in your notes as we were exchanging information about what we could talk about today, the idea that MDA is bringing back the telethon this year. Sounds like Kevin Hart is going to be heading that up. And I think that as a guy who
did graduate work in nonprofit management. I teach nonprofit and social enterprise students over at the college, and I have, we talk nonprofits on the show like this all the time. That's a pretty, that like really caught my attention. So tell me about that.
Absolutely. We couldn't be more proud, by the way. So do we all remember early in the beautiful pandemic, people started going on and doing these quote unquote telethon moments on TV and MDA.
They did, yeah.
Many people don't realize, especially younger people that know Lady Gaga, don't necessarily know the MDA telethon, but the MDA telethon created that experience. That multimedia giving experience started in the 1960s with MDA and the comedian and talent of Jerry Lewis. And it went on until 2014. So it's actually only been off the air for a short period of time.
Yeah.
But it, why wouldn't this be the year you bring it back? Clearly, we need to think differently. Clearly, there is a new way to think of a telethon. And we actually, unlike other organizations, we get to climb on top of the mountain we were on before and leap from there. So we're thrilled we get to bring the telethon back with someone like Kevin Hart as our host, who brings the comedy and the legacy that Jerry had in the telethon. And what he also brings is that this is a show for families, that this was a time in the 60s through the you know, early 2010s, people looked forward to Labor Day. They gathered together and they watched a telethon as a family. And so we're really committed to making this a multi-screen, multi-stream experience that your kids could game and be part of the telethon. You can watch the live stream. You can text and give. You can do your more traditional nonprofit peer-to-peer things. You can have some fun virtual watch parties in this new day and age, but that we bring it back to the generations as we used to.
Yeah, I have to. Okay, so I think a lot of us, so we're a family of, we have four children, and the experience with COVID and the lockdowns and those sorts of things, I mean, it's a tragic sort of reality in our world right now, but the silver lining in it all was we feel like as a family, we've sort of been closer together, and we spent 2 to 3 months sort of locked in our home, and we got along better, and Dad couldn't travel as much, and I resent the fact that now I'm occasionally getting back on airplanes and stuff, but Deb, there's a local gentleman in the reason I think this first and didn't occur to me when I when this first caught my attention reading through your notes is a local gentleman down in Maryland, just south of us, was doing a DJ type show, and he did it and he continues to do it. And he did it throughout the sort of the lockdown period of sort of our COVID experience here last couple, you know, 6 months ago or so. And he had like a national, by the third or fourth week of him doing this on Friday nights or something, he had this enormous following, and it's really what you're describing. But then the other thing that's kind of refreshing as I'm listening to you sort of describe this, sort of this bringing this back. And I didn't recall that you guys had only pulled the plug on it, you know, what, 6 years ago, is that, what a much more positive thing I would love for my kids to come across on Facebook right now. That's kind of what occurs to me too, is there's so many different streaming things, you know, with politics and news and all this other mess, is I would really just love for my kids to sort of be scrolling through something on their iPhones and come across this rather than something else. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's just, it does. I'm right there with you. I think it's totally timely. The other thing that it sort of occurs to me is, and I said this to someone else recently, it kind of feels providential. I'm a man of faith. And so I would say that it almost feels providential in that, you know, it was probably timely that you all unplugged it when you did, but that sort of allows you sort of the opportunity to sort of recalibrate and sort of make sure that the current platform, the current format is very relevant to sort of the now rather than being so hinged on the past. Am I right?
That's absolutely right. And imagine technology just the early 2010s. The things we get to do now, we couldn't have done, didn't exist before. And we also get permission to let go of things that maybe we don't need to do anymore. Great. Our attention spans have changed as a human community. And especially during COVID, we're a little screen tired. So the show has to change. The experience has to change because everyone's been watching screens since March. It's got to be different. It can't be even what you saw in May. And that we're very conscious of that. We want to be very sure that this program is engaging and exciting, but also that we're responsive and that we're catching that ongoing entertainment in social that you just mentioned, because mm-hmm. we realize everybody's multitasking. They're going to listen to this podcast, for example, and they're going to be scrolling on their phone for something else or doing their
texting.
Work,
yeah, they're going to be doing something.
Right? And that'll yeah. happen during the show. So we want to make sure we're all encompassing in our approach. We would have never done that in 2014. And we probably wouldn't yeah. have looked at it that way to reset the frame. Whereas now we get to really come at it from a 2020 forward approach. Well, how exciting.
But there's certainly a degree of optimism. So I'm working on a book project right now, and I'm talking about sort of the world being complex and unpredictable and so forth. And which obviously recent events have sort of proven that to be the case. But if you think of, I was working with a client two years ago, who really didn't want to pull the plug on this annual tradition of this. They had an annual gala that was just becoming a complete bore for the organizers. If people weren't attending, they weren't renewing sponsors, so forth. And they couldn't unplug it. But it almost seems like maybe hearing this story, because I think you're going to rekindle something with a purpose, but with sort of a different form and a different, you know, in a, the fun, it's that confusion that we oftentimes create between form and function. Mm-hmm. And as long as you get the purpose right, it's going to be, and I think about my 16-year-old, for example, it may come across my 16-year-old stream in a brand new way. And he's not going to know he's not going to know it the Jerry Lewis telethon. He's going to know it as the Kevin Hart telethon.
That's right. And he's going to know it, not even that. He's going to know it because he was on Twitch or, you know, playing video games. Right. And he was like, hey, I was doing this thing and have no real concept. And that's part of what's so wonderful about it. It's on that part about being family-based. One of the things that MDA had in the legacy of the telethon was kids grew up on it. It was this cause where you learned philanthropy at home. You learned it because it was part of the whole family. You called in together. You were excited together. And that's an opportunity we get to bring back. Nostalgia is really exciting right now. Why do you think we all want to watch Josh Gad's show, Reunited Together, because we love nostalgia, by the way, who's also a guest on the telethon. We're thrilled about that nostalgia, because this is kind of a beautiful moment for that.
So I don't know how close you are. I mean, I don't know how close you are to the planning, but is there excitement and energy, or is there tension, or could you even tell me with sort of wanting to hold on to what was once there, or is the organization approaching it in a complete brand new look? We're basically taking the general theme and the general purpose of what we're trying to do, but we're starting from the ground up. I mean, because from a planning standpoint, you have a framework, you have a frame of thinking mm-hmm. to sort of work from, but maybe you don't want any of that.
Mm-hmm. We're not going completely away, at least from where we sunset. So when the telethon ended, it was a 2-hour primetime show. And essentially, we're bringing Kevin back to host that 2-hour primetime show. But in addition to that, we're going to do what we did in the years past, and that is have extended content so that this streaming and further experience gets to continue, and that there will be other things to see. You're going to join us in the way you used to for the whole, or you want to tune back in for the whole 24-hour experience. So we're leaning into our nostalgia in that way. We're also leaning into, from a generational audience perspective, we will absolutely lean to our clips and moments of the past. That's our content. Why wouldn't you bring back those moments that make someone as old as I excited about my childhood memories that I get to remember with my parents as a kid and then share with my children now?
Are you going to involve Jerry's family? I mean, I think we lost Jerry in 2017, 2016, something like that. But are we going to involve his family?
They are softly involved with MDA. It's not been for years that we've been intimately involved, but what we are using is a lot of our Jerry content. So all of the content of the old show. A lot of the things and what we're trying to build is, how do you nod to that nostalgia in a way that doesn't become boring to your point of your 16-year-old going, who's this old? Right. Why is it black and white? As my children tease, they think TV didn't have sound when I was a kid. So you don't want to bore with too much looking back, but there is some fun to that. There were always fun bits, fun moments, fun guest speakers and drop-ins. That's the part that you get to lean in on, but you get to reinvent now very differently in a very positive way.
Yeah, I think my kid, you know, I'm sitting here, we're sort of analyzing my 16-year-old. But so last night I watched, so my kids and anybody's kids who's got 16-year-olds these days are watching, they watch these 20-minute, basically amateur produced sort of, kind of like my podcast here, produced YouTube shows. And there may be an appreciation for the old black and white stuff, because by what my son Gordon watches, for example, black and white's not a whole lot different when he looks at it. And my guess is when he looks at it, it's not a whole lot different than this Gold Rush show he was watching last night for this guy who him and his kid produced this show about, you know, looking for gold in the hills. And it's not something that's professional, you know, it's not something that's done by a major network.
Right.
So there may be an appreciation for that. That's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, we're really excited. We have a fantastic team. So United Entertainment Group, UEG in LA, is producing the show. And our director is Jonathan Crystal, who some will know from Portlandia and SNL. So that gives you a little feel for how the show's going to come out. And we're trusting them. They are fantastic. And they know what they're doing. We at MDA, we know how to generate philanthropy and passion and move our donors and our volunteers and our loyal friends for the last 70 years to join us. That's where we're really focused. And we're really trusting these great experts to come along and guide us. And Kevin has a vision, and you know, he's really excited about bringing the fun and the laughter into the show.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm really excited about that. When we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I want to hear about the MDA, and I want to talk about what it means to, I don't think a lot of we have not on the podcast talked about what it means to be part of a large network like you're a part of. So I look forward to having that conversation.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Heather Klein Olson, Responsive's leader in the Midwest. I want to encourage you to think about enlisting myself or another member of the Responsive team to introduce our four frameworks to your organization. Now is a time to begin thinking more critically about the work we do as fundraising professionals and how we create places where fundraising can thrive. Before your organization thinks about updating a strategic plan, launching a capital campaign, or hiring a new member of your fundraising team, let's ensure we're all aligned as fundraising professionals around a shared understanding of how fundraising really works. If you'd like to talk about how we might partner together, reach out today and let's start a conversation. My contact information will be in the show notes.
Deborah, I am really enjoying this conversation. We just talked about bringing back the MDA telethon. I'm excited about that. I'm one of the first podcasts to get to talk about it. I don't know. That's pretty exciting, especially in the fundraising space, because I know that's a tradition that a lot of us who've been in fundraising for a while sort of know and understand. But Deborah, I was sharing with you before we hit the record button that I was part of a large health charity in Washington for a while, and I got to understand what it means to work with a large network of charities like you're a part of at MDA. And I thought it might be interesting to just talk about for, you know, the rest of the show, 15 minutes or so, what it means to sort of be part of a large network like this, where you have a large national office and then local chapters in the midst of COVID and in sort of this modern era and in light of some of the other things we were talking about before the break.
Yeah, it's one of those things that we are one of many. So MDA is a sister organization to American Heart and Cystic Fibrosis and LLS and March of Dimes and many others who are organized like us. A lot of the health charities specifically, we are often multi-affiliates. We're one 501c3 with lots of local friends. And we work a little differently than even our friend organizations like a Boys and Girls Club, who are one brand, but all different 501c3s across the country, and certainly different than those beautiful local grassroots organizations that are genuinely in your community and solving a local community challenge. So structurally, we're different, and we tend to, just globally as organizations, we tend to try to solve the big problem. The big problem that maybe isn't as fun, for lack of a word, than some of the other problems. So with MDA, for example, we are the largest funder to neuromuscular disease research in the nation. Now, what people don't realize is that includes ALS. We're still the largest funder to ALS research besides the U.S. government, because it's not necessarily what everyone wants to work on. Now, while research might sound boring to some, a local organization sometimes has a really hard time raising the kind of money that's impactful to drive meaningful research, to drive research that brings therapies and treatments to life, where you go from beaker to bedside. That's hard to do, and it takes a lot of support. But at the same time, what I find so amazing about MDA, and I've only been with the organization about a year and a half, MDA is unique in the multi-affiliate space because we also provide direct service. We have a camp program that is open every summer, and this summer virtually, but open every summer to children with neuromuscular disease, where they can go for free to a week of camp. And as big charities, at least in my experience, in my career of many decades of doing this, many of us focus on that research play, but not many of us have this very tangible local program play at the same time. It's one of the things I think that makes MDA very unique and has kept us a truly national local organization, where mission is local, but our impact can be national because of the way we can drive advocacy and policy, research and therapies and influence in the right way and bring the masses together, but we can be local in how we support those that we care about.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of my listeners probably grasp the sort of the messy complexity. I use the word messy and complexity sort of interchangeably. It's I use messy in a positive way, but it can be difficult and it can be challenging. I remember when I was at the Epilepsy Foundation in Washington. So we were the large corporate, you know, shop in DC, at a large health charity. And I believe, if I understand the structure with epilepsy, if I understand it correctly, they were the, you know, a large corporate 501c3, and all the individual chapters around the country had their own unique 501c3s. And the challenge that, what you're describing is right along the line of what our experience was, but I was part of the major gifts team. And we were assumed to be very talented and had lots of access to infrastructure and information. And we had access to, you know, when I went up to Boston, for example, because epilepsy, you know, because the large corporate, you know, DC national office was oftentimes associated with the large research grants, I was able to secure the largest gifts from, say, the Boston, you know, the wealthiest Boston donors who were interested in that. That was oftentimes money that the local affiliate couldn't necessarily raise. And I don't think a lot of organizations who are not associate, you know, who sort of understand that sort of framework, understand that sort of messy complexity.
I think you're spot on about the messy complexity. It's a nice way to describe it. And in more cases than not, we national organizations were player coach. So we play that dual role of sometimes that you just described. You're that player. You're going in, you're making the ask, you're the one closing the deal. But the next hour, you'll be riding along with the local staff on their $25,000 ask to even a company. And you're coaching. You're playing a coach role, and you're teaching them some of the skills on active listening with a donor, on hearing the deeper conversation that might come up that they're just thinking about sponsor the event, and you're hearing, wow, they really care in their CSR about this, and we should talk to them about this other opportunity within our organization. The national organizations like us we have to play that player coach role a lot.
Yeah. Is the tension the same? Because what I remember was where resources were going. I remember we sort of, I don't remember if this was the exact language, but I sort of hear the language in what you were describing between whether resources essentially were going to sort of quality of life and community building initiatives that were usually more localized, and the research and sort of solving the problem, you know, at the very macro level. Is that essentially where the tension tends to be, sort of where the line tends to be for you all and others as well?
I think that's a very common line, especially in, so we're a health charity, and in a health charity, and I would assume with epilepsy, it was the same thing. The Epilepsy Foundation was the same thing, where the individual who has the disease that you're working on or the cause that you're working on, they need direct support and they need it today. And at the same time, their network, their community, and those that are not new to their diagnosis, they're hungry for cures. They're hungry for answers. They're seeking that next step. They've gotten through immediate response and they're ready for the next piece. And that dichotomy of being able to solve for everything, I think that's a challenge for a lot of our large organizations like MDA, is how do you be everything to everyone? And I think for a long time, we all tried to be everything to everyone instead of saying, no, we're going to be really good at these three things or five things. And we're going to be a wonderful referral and friend to another organization, cause, or resource who can do the things we don't do. And I think COVID's actually opened that in a wonderful way, where more and more nonprofits are talking to each other, more and more companies are talking to nonprofits about how they can help solve our challenges that we can't solve ourselves. It's opened up that conversation that we may not need to answer every need, but we might be a great way to help guide to a resource.
So forgive me, I'm not in tune with the MDA community, and I don't know, we all sort of live in our unique worlds, and that's unfortunate. But how does the last, say, six, 9 months with COVID and with the social unrest and that sort of stuff, how does all that play out in your community?
Very much so. We, like many of the larger affiliates, we're very event-based, just like so many of the other large health charities. We had walks, we had galas, we had golf tournaments, we had all those.
Yeah, of course
things,
you did, right.
Right? Like everyone else did. And what RAISE is all about are these events that we used to have and we used to do in person. And we did what everyone else did. We pivoted to as much virtual as we could. We worked to retain our friends as much as we could. And it's part of the reason we decided to bring the telephone back. It was, well, we could keep doing that and we could keep doing what everyone else is doing. Or we could actually take a very bold move and stand out and make sure that our mission doesn't get lost during COVID. We represent a group of 43 diseases in the neuromuscular disease space that are relatively rare. They aren't getting all the attention. The people we serve are of high risk because of the respiratory impacts of COVID. Yeah. And we have to stand for them. We have to fight to keep our cause here. So telethon was response to that. Let's do something completely different and not do what every other large health charity has to do right now. And that's pivot, work on retention. Let's try something big and bold. It's big and it's bold. It's a little less bold for us because it's where we used to be. So it's a little less scary maybe than for another organization to start a telethon. But like everyone else, our revenues are down just like every other health charity. We range just like everyone I've heard and hearing at RAISE over the last few days, your revenues are down somewhere around 40 to 60%. And it just depends on the event, how much money you had before the pandemic hit, what kind of constituents you were recruiting for that moment, what kind of loyalty and strength those partners, both individual and corporate, had on your direct program funding. That's what we're all trying to solve for now, is that next.
So I have to imagine that as we're sort of wrapping up this discussion, the sort of the final question I wanted to, I have to imagine with this, going back to the what we talked about before the break, the idea of sort of the telethon coming back on, is the tone at the MDA upbeat and positive and forward looking?
It is upbeat and positive and forward looking in the sense of a couple of things. And that is, even during the pandemic, two new therapies came to market that support the diseases we fight for. So technology has caught up with, finally, and is creating advances. So we're thrilled, because we already were excited that over the last 5 years, more therapies had come to market than over the previous 50. But even during COVID, we had two more. We're thrilled about that. And we are hungry and excited to keep fighting for that kind of discovery. We're thrilled about the pivot we made in virtual camp this summer, where we got to bring programming to kids that, quite honestly, was pretty innovative and life-changing. Things like how to solve a problem like a firefighter, which was this cool escape room experience with our number one volunteer partner at the IAFF, helping us to put together a really cool program for our kids, but also this really amazing fashion design, adaptable fashion design experience for people. Because we often overlook, when we talk about being all abilities and all access, fashion is one of those areas that isn't yet. And we got to bring a camp session, essentially, to our young people about how to create adaptable clothing and be fashionable and be included. And we probably wouldn't have dug deep on that if not for the pandemic. How cool that we got to offer that kind of programming, and we get to boldly speak and work with our audience in a meaningful way. That's pretty awesome. That's the part we're really excited about. That's what we fight for every day, is to keep doing that, keep bringing those therapies and programs to life.
Deborah, I have really enjoyed this conversation. Probably one of the highlighted, I'll put this at the top of my favorite list, because I really appreciate the MDA and the sort of the historical significance and Jerry Lewis and all that stuff. I've been studying nonprofit work and nonprofit management for a long time, and so I pay attention to sort of the history. So I appreciate the update. If there's someone out there who's interested, curious, wants to continue this conversation, maybe just wants to reach out and be a friend with you or the organization, how would you suggest that they do that?
Oh, LinkedIn would be great. I'm on LinkedIn as well, like you are. And it's been so fun to connect with people, even through Raise. Come back on LinkedIn and say hi. It's been wonderful.
Yeah. Deborah, you're always welcome back. All you got to do is have a big idea or bold opinion about the fundraising profession. It's certainly been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.